Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. My name's Mark Williams and I'm broadcasting to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. And it is sunny today. After the coolest August for 10 years in the UK, finally summer has arrived. It's 28 degrees Celsius outside. It's perfect weather for the last day of the fourth test between England and India at the Oval in London. I'm not in London today. I've got something much better to do, to talk to my guest, but he and I will both be in London next week. As part of London International Shipping Week, we will be appearing in person, and we'll tell you more about that in a moment. But first, to introduce my guest, Mr. John Phillips, the Managing Director of Auralas Limited. I first met John back in 2002 when I was working as a credit analyst for a company called MRC, and I was on my way out, ready to go and join HSBC Bank, and John was on his way in, and John already had at least 15 years experience by that stage, I think, in shipping and bunkers. And he has had a global industry in marine fuels and in credit. Most recently, he was well known in Singapore, but has come back in the last couple of years to the United Kingdom to help solve our post-Brexit trade deficit. John, welcome to the podcast. It's lovely to have you on board.
It's nice to be here, Mark.
So, John, I just trailed. You and I are both speaking at London International Shipping Week, and we have the Ship Energy Summit coming up before that. And so I just wanted to sort of ask you, with these two big events coming up, what do you think are the big topics around marine fuels that people are going to be talking about?
Oh, I don't think there's any major doubt that the key topic will always be in the area of the fuels and the alternate fuels and the fuel choices. I mean, whether you're looking at it as a difference between whether you're going to burn the traditional heavy fuels or scrub it as the scrub it. I shouldn't use that phrase these days. I've been told it's waste gas abatement system or something. But whether it's that or the true alternative.
We'll let you say scrubbing, that's all right.
Yeah. I'm not going to get drawn on that one, Mark. But scrubbing, or whether it is the actual low sulfur fuels or indeed the true alternate fuels, the growth in LNG fuels, methanols, there are so many now that it's becoming very difficult for ship owners and operators to actually start planning what they're going to do, let alone handling what's happening every day. That is probably one of the key areas which is playing on everybody's mind. But then at the same time, there's the fact that this certainly hasn't been an easy period, and it's easy to say the last 2 years have focused everything with a number of high-level collapses of major marine fuels businesses, especially in Singapore with GP and Hin Leong in 2020. But that's a trait which has been going on for quite a bit longer. I mean, you can wind that line back through OW at 2014 to 2013-2014 issues there, going back even further. So the topics are always, in my mind, going to revolve around what the fuel choice is, what the mix of fuels are which you're planning to actually use, which then is something more for the ship owners operators, and then for everybody else, am I going to get paid for whatever it is I stick on board?
Yeah. Before we get to the am I going to get paid bit, I think that come back to one of the other things you mentioned there about, you know, understanding all the different fuels. But marine fuels bunker traders have always had to be technically competent, you know, to understand the intricacies of the specifications of the product that they're acquiring on behalf of their customers. With all the different alternative fuels, how much more of a headache is it then for traders to be able to get their head around the specifications and the engines and the infrastructure and the global network of distribution for all these different fuels? Is it possible for people to replicate this from trader to trader to trader in short order, or are we all just going to have to learn by doing?
I think it's going to take quite a bit of time, and certainly what I would think is key here is that those larger trading houses involved in the sector now. And I mean, ship owners have always had a good handle on this side of it anyway. And that is, you need to have the right technical people involved in the business. And we now see that reflecting with some of the hires which are going into these larger trading houses, support functions, where it's no longer good enough just to say, okay, I'm supplying you with low sulfur fuel oil. You need to know exactly what that product is, because the claim side potential is exceptionally real. And that's just looking at the simple hydrocarbon based side. Now, if we start looking at sort of LNGs, and I've got some very good friends with developing very good markets in trading LNG as a bunker fuel. But if you're going to do that, do you have the requisite people on board within your organization to actually give the best advice? Because the ramifications for getting these things wrong go beyond dollars and cents.
How so? Is it, you mean, in terms of physical damage to the vessels, or?
I'm looking at quite serious physical damage. I mean, again, I'm not a technical man by any stretch of the imagination, despite the fact you're looking over my shoulder at a model of a ship there. I might have been brought up around ships all of my life and on board ships, but the technicality side of it is something which I don't profess to have. And therefore, if I was sat as an MD of a medium or large bunker trading business, I would want those skills within my organization. They are people which you have to actually bring in. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's a former master who has a good reputation behind him, or a former chief engineer. I mean, these people have been in our industry and around us for years and years, but there seems to be quite a few of them coming towards retirement at the moment. And then a massive gap, because I don't think we've really been making it attractive enough. The oil majors were certainly taking these sort of skills in the past, but some of the trading houses maybe haven't been taking them. I mean, the one which maybe books the trend, which comes immediately to mind, fairly high profile, of course, is Integrate.
Yeah, how would, tell us more. How do you see them booking that trend?
Well, I mean, I suppose with them sitting in a middle ground between being a bunker trader and actually being a ship operator, being part of the wider Navigate structure. They certainly understand a little bit more about the technicality side than maybe some of their peers. I'm not saying all of them, because a lot of them really do actually have some very good people in play there. But for the smaller traders, the smaller medium-sized ones who maybe don't have the financial resources to bring those sort of people in, it's quite a challenging time. Because the technicalities are getting more and more challenging as the days go by.
But certainly, I think the fuel specification discussions and the engine discussions are getting more advanced and therefore more complex. We've gone beyond concept and we're starting to get into practice with a number of these fuels now. For instance, Maersk's order for these methanol container ships. Just on that one, do you think this is going to fire the starting gun now? Because we've seen 300 or so container ship orders this year. Probably only 25% of them have been ordered with alternative fuel capability. Nearly all of those have been with LNG capability. Then Maersk pop up having recused themselves from using LNG, and they say, actually, we're going to wait until better technologies are available. They've placed this order for the 8 methanol dual fuel container ships. Do you think that's, I'll get to my question eventually, do you think that's fired the starting gun for others? I mean, is there anybody else left out there to order methanol powered container ships?
Well, I'm going out on a little bit of a limb now, and of course other opinions are available. This is just my personal one, but I think the situation with Maersk is always different to almost anybody else who you speak to. We've had many, many discussions in the past about blockchain and the introduction of blockchain into shipping and bunkering and everything else. And people keep throwing up the example of Maersk, Maersk this, Maersk that, Maersk the other. But typically, Maersk as a business on the shipping side, you'll have a domination by Maersk Container because they've pretty much let go of everything else anyway. It's a Maersk box, which is owned by Maersk or leased by Maersk, which goes into a Maersk customer. The Maersk customer, the tractor unit, is a Maersk tractor unit, which takes into a Maersk port, where a Maersk crane lifts it onto a Maersk ship, which then ships it around the world. And if the bunkers are supplied, it's typically Maersk supplying the bunkers. It's very easy to actually do blockchain with those sort of structures in play. For everybody else, they don't have that's a large structure in play. And that's exactly the same when it comes to what we're talking about now and fuel choice. Now, if Maersk say, yeah, we're going to slowly move over to methanol, and already people are talking about these ships are going to consume all the available methanol in the market currently anyway. But if anybody can actually do it, Maersk can certainly do it. But that doesn't mean that's going to work for everybody else, because not everybody else is going to have the structures, the terminals where they can supply and the pockets deep enough to go after alternate fuels as a leader. Once they've created capacity, like everything else, once you've got enough volume in the market, you can then start seeing how others can take advantage of that, because once you've created a short, you've got to sell it no matter what it is. So, the fact that Maersk are doing it, I think, is excellent for the industry. Is it going to signal a massive move towards everybody else moving into methanol next week? No, it's not. No more than the movement of people into LNG 2 or 3 years ago is going to make everybody burn LNG, because until you've got rid of 98% of the current fleet, you can't burn these fuels.
In response to your comment, I would say that this then may work for Maersk because of their commercial structure, because of their business model. That doesn't necessarily translate into it being viable for lots of other liner companies or other ship owners at the moment. And it tallies with conversations I've been having. People saying, you know, how is there a first mover advantage, or how do we move into these different marine fuels? And I think the answer at the moment is it doesn't really depend on what ship type you're operating or what size company you are. It's about the business model. If you know where you're calling and you know when you're calling and you know what your energy requirements are, then you can start to put in a plan to replace fuel oil or diesel oil with lower carbon dioxide emitting alternatives. If you're a tramp operator, a traditional tramp operator, it's much harder because you don't know necessarily what your energy requirements are going to be far enough in advance to be able to book those energy requirements in.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with that at all. I mean, that's exactly how I've seen it for quite a while, and why. I'm a little bit surprised LNG is getting the traction right now. There's been some other drivers behind it to actually bring it along at the pace it is, but we still don't have the port infrastructures. We still don't have enough trained people. My younger brother's master on an LNG ship, and he's 50, and it's taken him pretty much all of his career to get to that level. So if you start looking, as we said earlier, for these skill sets ashore, there aren't that many of those people available yet. And it's going to take time before we can put well-trained managers ashore to watch, supervise, guide these type of operations.
Yeah, there's definitely the skill issue to overcome, isn't there? And skills are somewhat cyclical. I feel that when I fell into shipping, it was part of the Asian Tiger era, when there was a lot of economic growth, there were people being hired, And then, of course, in the slumps, everyone gets laid off, and then we'll get rehired again in the economic boom times. And there are often skills gaps that develop as a consequence of that. And to some extent, I suspect that the skills gap in shipping is due to the fact that shipping went, after the global financial crisis, went through pretty much a 10-year downturn in which nearly all sectors simultaneously were experiencing misery and deprivation. And therefore, there wasn't a lot of hiring going on. We've got to move quite quickly now to upskill in order to be able to operate under all these new fuels and the infrastructures and distribution networks and terminals and everything else that's going to be required to be able to get them out of the ground in whatever source into the ships themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a challenge. We certainly have a challenge. I can certainly speak for the UK. It's something we didn't see so much of in Singapore. In Singapore, there was definitely an automatic acknowledgement of probably the majority of the populace there that the country existed because of the sea, and everything came by sea pretty much, and therefore to enter into a maritime related industry was seen as being something very positive. Whereas in the UK, we still have this, I think a few years ago they used to call it sea blindness, where far too many people seem to think that everything comes from Tesco's and that's the end of it, when in actual fact, we are, like Singapore and Ireland.
Yes, it's all 3D printed in the back of the convenience store.
Yeah, yeah. I'm yet to find a very satisfactory tin of 3D printed beans, which tastes good. I think it's upon us, and certainly our generation now. Mark, I'm going to say our generation. I know this is a little bit unfair on you, though, because I think I'm a little bit ahead of you. But it's upon us to try and reinstill that interest in the sector. And it's a fantastic sector to actually be involved in, because it touches right across everything which we do every day. I mean, I was having a conversation at a garden party on Saturday with a lawyer, not a maritime lawyer, just a housing lawyer. And he immediately acknowledged that a lot of the law which they use comes down to commercial law, and that commercial law was all brought in for the shipping industry. And he knew what a freezing injunction was straight away. And we were talking about vessel arrests and all these sort of things. So it certainly is an interesting industry. It's certainly not a sexy industry anymore. I think that went in the 70s like everything else, but it's one which can still reward those who want to be involved in it. And I do think it's important that we encourage people now, whether that's through commercial interest, through the universities, through bodies like the Institute of Chartered Shipbrokers, the Institute of Marine Engineers, IBEA, whatever, you find the body which can promote and push. And of course, we were talking about Maersk earlier. Maersk have been world leaders at this, at bringing people through. It's very rare you interact with a globally trading company which hasn't got at least one, if not two or three, former Maersk employees working for it.
Yeah. Quite so. It's finishing school for people who want to be shipping executives, isn't it? It
certainly is. Not for me, though. Even though I noticed today both of us wearing Maersk blue.
You've recently moved back to the UK with Our Lass. What's Our Lass going to be doing?
All right. Okay. Well, the concept behind Our Lass goes back almost 10 years now. We had a business in Singapore not long after I arrived there, which was looking to develop a credit model specifically for the marine fuel sector and to take on some little projects here and there. That business we folded away because of my time working for large oil companies there. I mean, you can't run both things at the same time. So coming back to the UK earlier this year, it made sense to maybe reinvestigate how we could get the business up and going again. Because one of the big holes we saw in the market was that there were many companies out there in the bunker sector, bunker supply especially, but it's also bunker trading, who maybe wanted to have the skill sets which the larger companies could have as far as credit is concerned and counterparty risk management. Not the financial side of that, more the counterparty intelligence, so understanding your customers better. I think I've many times explained it as you've got your Infospectrum reports, you've got your Lloyd's List intelligence, you've got your Dynamite reports, you've got your CCRED reports and all these sort of things, but really interpreting those and putting the commercial spin on them as to how to use them properly in a commercial environment. So we set up this business with the idea of taking the rather onerous costs which exist and spreading it a little bit wider so that we can bring some more of those smaller companies in with best practice, because we know a lot of them want it, they just can't afford it. So we've standardized our credit modeling, we've standardized credit policy, the processes and procedures, and we can just then adjust them to meet the specifics of each customer based upon their capacity and their risk appetite, because everybody is slightly different. It's not our job to tell the managing director of a company what his risk appetite should be. Our job would be to give him recommendations which fit his risk appetite. So that's where we're taking it at the moment, and it's going fairly well. It's nice being back in the UK, working from home, which is very nice. West Wales, which is even nicer, you know.
Yes, back in the homeland, land of my fathers.
Land of my fathers, yeah.
Very good. John, I ask most people who come onto the podcast this question, and I know there isn't an easy answer to it, but that's partly why I ask it. What's the John Phillips expert view on the marine fuel of the future? Do you see one or more of the alternative fuels that are out there being the main replacement for fuel oil and diesel, or is it going to be something else that we haven't thought of yet?
I feel you've got to look at the rapid pace which we're running at the moment, the way which there's been acceleration in interest in the alternative fuels, in the LNG, methanol. If we think back over you know 50, 100 years, where we moved from sail to steam, and then steam powered by coal into motor, well into steam powered by oil, into diesel and lighter fuels, that took an awful long time. The one thing which we're seeing at the moment is a massive acceleration. So do I think that there is going to be other fuels which we haven't thought of yet? Yes, I do. And they're going to come at us constantly because of the amount of information we've got available now and the speed of information flow. All these things are going to lead towards an environment where people become more aware and want to try things. And certainly something which we've not heavily talked about. I mean, we all are aware of the green lobby and the fact that we all need to actually do our little bit. I mean, I'm starting Pembrokeshire here, which is almost a market leader as far as the UK is concerned with their waste collection. I mean, it's fantastic here. So we all play our part, and I think the shipping industry has long already played its part, and will continue to actually do so. So it itself will look for those alternatives and find ways. Will it be electromagnetic? Will it be nuclear? Will it be wind power? Will it be LNG fueling everything? I really do not think so. I think it'll be an absolute mix of many, many things. And the only inhibitor to that, I think, is going to be people's imagination, financial capacity, and this is the important one, the structure to actually do it. Because until those fuels become available and people understand how to supply them, how to manage them on board ships, they are not going to become mainstream. So for the foreseeable future, for my working future, it will still be hydrocarbon-based marine fuels, low sulfur fuels. if we ever go back to pure diesel burning on everything, then that's going to be almost like returning a circle back to the 1940s, early 50s, maybe. But that's going to be massively expensive in ways which a lot of people haven't actually thought about, because there's going to be an awful lot more refining going on if we're going to be doing that.
So no magic bullet. It's going to be a question of lots of different solutions for different challenges.
I'll give you the magic bullet the minute you give me tonight's lottery numbers, winning lottery numbers.
there's an old joke about a chap who prays every night. He says, God, please send me the winning lottery numbers. And one night God replies in his dream, meet me halfway and buy a ticket. So on that terrible joke, we have to leave it there. Thank you, John Phillips, for joining us on the podcast. And thank you to all of you out there in podcast land for listening. And join us again soon for another edition of the Ship Energy Podcast. Thanks and goodbye.